Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman in Paris, a race to beat a deadline in the battle against climate change. With about a day to go before a Friday deadline, delegates of 196 countries meeting in a Paris suburb are in a race to reach a wide-reaching climate agreement. However, hurdles over money and targets remain large. A 29-page draft of the agreement released Wednesday shows differences remain substantial, especially on key questions involving the responsibility of richer nations to fund climate change programs for poorer countries. Core ideas of dispute also include the demand by developing nations for an agreement and corresponding commitments to prevent global temperatures from rising a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urged delegates to use this opportunity to finalize what he called an ambitious, inclusive, and durable global climate agreement, saying damage is going to increase exponentially if too many people wait for something else or someone else to take responsibility.
We are prepared to do our part, and we will not leave the most vulnerable nations among us to quite literally weather the storm alone.
The top U.S. diplomat said the United States has committed to double its investments from $400 million to $800 million over the next 5 years to help poorer countries adapt. However, the delivery of that assistance could be in question, as members of the Republican-led U.S. Congress have indicated they plan to block the funding. Make sure you follow the progress of this story from Paris and its environs on our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Talks in Saudi Arabia between various Syrian opposition factions have been very constructive, but it's too soon to lock in a new international diplomatic meeting to begin a UN-led political process aimed at ending Syria's civil war. That's what U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said. Speaking at a climate conference outside Paris, Kerry said he had talked to Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir about the opposition gathering in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and to the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov with the aim of organizing the next Syria meeting, tentatively set for December 18th at the United Nations.
We are planning towards the potential of a meeting in New York. Not locked in yet, but the meeting in Saudi Arabia appears to be very constructive at this point, and we need to wait for the results of that conference. But I think everybody is moving in the direction that they want to.
The top U.S. diplomat has been working the telephones as he attended that global climate summit outside Paris. In Australia, authorities charged a teenager and 4 men Thursday with planning terrorist attacks on government buildings, including the headquarters of the Australian Federal Police in Sydney, and on random civilians. Earlier in the day, police arrested a 15-year-old boy and a 20-year-old man from Western Sydney and charged them with conspiracy to prepare for a terrorist act. Australian Federal Police Deputy Commissioner Michael Phelan said that to reporters.
Since December, our detectives within that task force have been working tirelessly to put together all of the evidence as a result of the search warrants that were executed on those days in December, as well as numerous amounts of electronic surveillance and physical surveillance activity, and have today culminated in what we believe is sufficient evidence to be able to put forward the court to charge this morning 2 individuals with conspiracy to prepare for a terrorism act.
3 other men already in jail on separate terrorism-related charges were charged with being part of that plot, according to the police. If convicted, all face a potential sentence of life in prison. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump says he's postponing a trip to Israel, saying he'll reschedule talks with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu after he becomes president. Trump made the remark on Twitter amid protests by Israeli lawmakers, both left and right-wing, over his proposal to ban Muslims from entering the United States. News reports this week had said a meeting between Trump and Netanyahu in Israel was scheduled to take place December 28th. At least 37 Israeli legislators, most from the opposition, sent a letter calling on the cancellation.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Efforts to resolve Burundi's political crisis remain stalled 5 months after President Pierre Nkurunziza won a controversial re-election. Meanwhile, residents of the capital continue to wake up to fresh bodies on the streets in the mornings.
That's Mohamed Yusuf, just back from Bujumbura, looking at what chance there is for a negotiated end to the crisis and the violence. Details coming up. Also in the news, the U.S. Senate holds a hearing today on South Sudan. And the United States has offered tactical war equipment to support Cameroon in its fight against Boko Haram. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee is holding a hearing today in Washington on South Sudan. The hearing focuses on the country's descent into war and efforts to restore peace. The hearing is entitled Independent South Sudan, A Failure of Leadership. The first witness was Ambassador Donald Booth, U.S. Special Envoy to the country. He says the current peace deal is the best chance to end the violence.
The people of South Sudan have no greater friend than the United States. We stood with them, as you've noted, during their long struggle for self-determination. We helped broker the comprehensive peace agreement and invested considerable resources in the run-up to and following their independence. But sadly, 2 years after independence, South Sudan's leaders decided to squander their country's future and far too many lives in a political power struggle. Today, thanks in part to U.S. leadership and engagement, South Sudan does have a chance for a fresh start. It has the opportunity to close the door on conflict and reclaim the promise we saw at its birth. I want to emphasize up front that the peace agreement signed in August, despite all the challenges of implementation since then, offers the best chance to put South Sudan back on the path to peace and development.
Ambassador Booth says reaching a deal did not remove all the obstacles to restoring peace and security.
Discussions over security arrangements for Juba and the opposition's return to the capital have become as complex and drawn out as the peace negotiations themselves. We've heard negative rhetoric from the government directed at the United Nations and at countries like the United States that are working to support the people of South Sudan. And far too regularly, we have heard from both government and opposition that we, the United States and other donor countries, are the ones who must foot the bill for peace or else watch South Sudan return to war. In response, our message has been clear and consistent. The United States has and will continue to support peace in South Sudan, but our funding for implementation will be commensurate with the seriousness of the commitment of both parties to realizing peace. And I want to emphasize that the agreement would not have come about without the intensive diplomatic efforts of the United States.
He also says peace is not assured in South Sudan.
Getting South Sudan's parties to implement the peace agreement and bringing lasting peace to South Sudan will require continued intensive diplomatic effort. We are not naive. There are several ways this path can fail, and we would have to respond quickly in a manner consistent with any new reality. But as I said earlier, the signed peace agreement, for all the challenges of implementation, currently offers the best chance for peace in South Sudan.
That was Ambassador Donald Booth, U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. He testified today before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Studies have shown that the poor usually bear the brunt of the effects of climate change, but a new study says if current climate policies don't change, things will get even worse for the poor in future generations. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Princeton University researchers say their model is the first to consider how climate change and policies to deal with it affect the rich and poor in the same country. And they say, as it stands now, there will be very unequal outcomes. So they're calling for aggressive policies to protect the world's most vulnerable populations. Mark Flerbe is co-lead author of the study in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He says, based on country commitments at the Paris Climate Conference, efforts to restrict rising temperatures will fall short. As a result, Fleurbe says, there are going to be major negative effects. That's even if rising temperatures are below the so-called catastrophic level of 5 degrees Celsius.
We stumble on this big fact that we didn't really expect, which is the following. It looks like the trajectory that we are heading for is something like 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial level rather than 2, which is the official target. And the general discussion about these targets in terms of temperature is that beyond 5 or 6 degrees, it's likely that we will have catastrophes, really big catastrophes at the macroeconomic level. But in fact, what we find in our analysis is that even at 3 degrees, we will have catastrophes for the poor people.
Fleurbe is professor of economics and humanistic studies at the Woodrow Wilson School and the Center for Human Values at Princeton.
We look at various possibilities in our analysis, but for many of them, we find that growth of income for the poor, especially in the regions like India or Africa or China, the growth is seriously endangered by temperatures as low as 2.5 or 3 degrees Celsius. And therefore, catastrophe is already there, right? So we have to do something more ambitious if we want to avoid catastrophes for the future poor.
The computer model shows it's the poorest 20% that's most at risk from a projected rise of 3 degrees Celsius.
If we take the lenient policy that is recommended by the basic version of the model and we make the assumption that the poor can be seriously hit, their growth rate will be either zero or even negative in the future, and so they could go down to essentially a starvation level or death at the end of the century due to the climate damages.
The study looks not only at climate effects for the rich and poor between regions, but also within regions.
Both are interesting to distinguish because between regions you have geographical factors which are very important in the prediction of climate impact, whereas within region and especially within countries, it's more a matter of the socioeconomic organization, the policies that are decided by governments in terms of adaptation and infrastructure and social policies, right? So it's good to be able to capture these various dimensions.
Fleurbe says when you change the assumption of who is hit hardest by climate impacts, very different results emerge.
The rich own the equipment, the buildings and things like that, so they will also be hit potentially, but the poor are the most vulnerable in terms of health impacts, mortality, crop yields and this sort of thing. So we need to know more about that. There is very little research so far.
The Princeton professor adds that the policies of today need to keep in mind such inequalities to protect future generations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's Kim Lewis is covering some of the discussions by NGOs and policymakers attending the conference. Today she spoke with Stephanie Simard of the French NGO called ACTED, or Act for Change, Invest in Tomorrow. It works to reduce poverty in Mali. Ms. Simard explains.
In Mali, we are acting in the north of the country. So the impact of the climate change is improving the lean season. You know, the lean season is the period when the food stock of our soil are finished, and is a period who is finished with the new harvest. So traditionally, this period is during 3 or 4 months, and with the climate change, this period is improving until 6 months. So during this period, our soil have to access to food with changing their comportment. So maybe they can sell their productive asset and have negative comportment. So, and in the same time, the price on the food in the market are improving. So ACTED is is acting to support this household by cash transfer during this period to have to support their access to food in the market and to have an impact for more long term. We are doing to support income activity, income generating activity. So we help households to develop, to diversify their activity, to be more resilient at the long term.
This sounds like a number of challenges that Malians are facing right now. So what needs to be done to help?
This is the one of the reasons why we are at the COP 21, because we have in the country we are acting at a local level, so Africa is not the more polluted the countries who are generate more pollution or are an impact a big impact on climate change. So we have to be here to represent them, to be more a part of the negotiation.
That's Stephanie Simard of the French NGO called ACTED, or Act for Change, Invest in Tomorrow. She was speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. The first plane load of Syrian refugees is expected to arrive in Canada today. Reuters says Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced a flight this morning. A second flight is expected on Saturday. The refugees have lived in refugee camps for as many as 4 years after fleeing civil war in their homeland. Canada plans to resettle more than 25,000 Syrians now living in refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan. Approximately 10,000 are expected to arrive by the end of December. Another 15,000 are expected in the next 2 months. Canadian officials are now interviewing more Syrians living in refugee camps in Amman and Beirut. The bodies of 11 migrants, meanwhile, have been found on Moroccan shores. Their vessel sank in bad weather on Monday during an apparent attempt to reach the Canary Islands. Moroccan rescuers are looking for possible survivors. In the past, other African migrants have embarked from Morocco and Tunisia in an effort to reach Libya for a longer Mediterranean crossing to Italy. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee is holding a hearing today in Washington on South Sudan. The hearing focuses on the country's descent into war and our efforts to restore peace. Studies have shown that the poor usually bear the brunt of the effects of climate change. And Canada plans to resettle more than 25,000 Syrians now living in refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. A Rwandan believed to be one of the main instigators of the 1994 genocide has been arrested in the Democratic Republic of Congo. UN and military intelligence sources say agents from Interpol have picked up Ladislas Ntaganzwa, 53. He was arrested in the eastern Congo city of Goma late Monday. The French news agency says he's expected to stand trial in Rwanda. He's a former mayor of Inyakuzi commune in southeastern Rwanda. He was indicted in 1996 by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda on charges of genocide and related crimes. And Ntaganzwa is one of 9 suspects still wanted by the UN for their alleged role in the genocide. John Bosco Siboyintori, the chief of the Genocide Tracking Unit at the Rwanda Public Prosecution Authority, said. And Ntungwaza is among the nine most wanted fugitives in the 1994 genocide, which killed more than 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and moderate Hutus. The other eight suspects are still at large. And Ntungwaza is accused of organizing mass rapes and the massacre of thousands during the genocide, which left about 800,000 people dead. The U.S. issued a $5 million reward for his arrest and called him one of the main instigators of the genocide. Efforts to resolve Burundi's political crisis remain stalled 5 months after President Pierre Nkurunziza won a controversial re-election. Meanwhile, residents of the capital continue to wake up to fresh bodies on the streets in the mornings. Mohamed Yusuf, just back from Bujumbura, looks at what chance there is for a negotiated end to the crisis and the violence.
Another night in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. As the sound of gunfire rings across the city, most of the clashes are between police and armed vigilantes. When day breaks, it is time for the residents to count the dead. Seven people were killed on Wednesday, adding to the toll of at least 240 who have already died since April. Residents told VOA the daily violence has become part of their lives and that they fear for worse. President Pierre Nkurunziza was re-elected in July, but his critics insist he violated the constitution and the Arusha Accord, which ended the country's civil war. Both documents limit the president's 2 terms in office. Nkurunziza's supporters say his first term didn't count against the limit, as he was elected by parliament, not popular vote. The United Nations, European Union and other bodies have called on Burundi's government to hold talks with the opposition. In an interview with VOA Thursday, Foreign Affairs Minister Alain Nyamitwe commented on the consultation they had this week with the EU.
They said that they have not frozen the cooperation, but they were considering additional measures in case our dialogue did not yield results. And we are hopeful that the dialogue that we have had, plus the work that we are going to undertake from now, are going to yield positive results, which would not warrant any other negative measures.
Pankaj Chipanye is deputy spokesman of Burundi's opposition alliance, SINARED, that includes members of civil society and political parties. He is discouraged with the progress of efforts to resolve the crisis.
Well, you need to negotiate. You have to negotiate with your enemy, not with your friends. Or if they are just planning to organize dialogue inside Burundi, it means that they want to dialogue between friends. So it's not helpful.
The opposition alliance still insists the president should resign and make way for an interim government.
We need to have first a transitional government, maybe for 1 year or 2 years. It's up to the transition government to prepare a fair election in a peaceful situation. Right now, it's quite impossible.
The East African Community Regional Bloc appointed President Yoweri Museveni to facilitate talks between the government and the opposition. But many fear the Ugandan election, due to be held early 2016, have distracted him. U.S. envoy to the Great Lakes region, Thomas Perriello, says Burundians have solved problems through dialogue before.
We know from Burundi's own history that dialogue has worked in the past. The foundations of the Arusha Accord, we believe, have been successful in building a decade of peace in Burundi. And that's one of the things we have to remember for all of the scariness of the situation, that up until about a year ago, it was in many ways a success story.
The African Union has launched a fact-finding mission to Burundi to investigate human rights violations and other abuses against Burundi civilians. The investigators then will give its finding to the AU Peace and Security Council. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The United States has offered tactical war equipment to support Cameroon in its fight against Boko Haram. The equipment was received late yesterday, 2 months after the United States deployed troops to Cameroon to help the Central African nation fight the Islamist militant group. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Michael Hosa, the United States ambassador to Cameroon, says the tactical war equipment, high technological combat vehicles, and high power generators are a gift from the American people to help Cameroon crush the terrorist group Boko Haram.
They provide water, electricity, maneuverability, etc. That follows the delivery of armored vehicles that actually engage in combat with the enemy. But this is just equipment. The real fight is done by the courage of Cameroonian military forces. We're very proud to partner with them. We will not only deliver equipment, but we will continue delivering information, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and we will provide assistance and training as necessary as requested by the government of Cameroon.
In October, 300 American troops arrived in Cameroon's northern town of Garoua to help combat Boko Haram's insurgency, which spilled across the border from Nigeria in 2013. Boko Haram has killed hundreds of people in Cameroon since then, in addition to more than 10,000 in Nigeria since 2009. Cameroonian Defense Minister Joseph Beti Asomo says the assistance shows Cameroon has friends in its battle against the Islamist radical group.
Vous devez le prier de bien vouloir transmettre au gouvernement des États-Unis.
He says the government and people of the United States should be informed that the people of Cameroon are very delighted to know that they are being supported in the fight against the terror group Boko Haram. He says the support will help Cameroon soldiers to score more success in the fight against the insurgents, and that Cameroon is delighted the assistance is coming less than 2 months after U.S. troops arrived in Cameroon to help stop terrorism. Earlier this week, Cameroon announced it had freed 900 people held captive by Boko Haram and expressed gratitude to the U.S. force in Garoua for providing intelligence. Last year, the United States declared Boko Haram a foreign terrorist organization and placed a $7 million bounty on its leader, Abubakar Shekau. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
From the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Kande Greaves. If symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain, within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
VOA News. VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Efforts to resolve Burundi's political crisis remain stalled 5 months after President Pierre Nkurunziza won a controversial re-election. And the United States has offered tactical war equipment to support Cameroon in its fight against Boko Haram. Coming up, music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, opposition People's Democratic Party leader Tenda Biti is urging Zimbabweans to reject the so-called mega China deal until their contents are made public. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Thursday, Yehias.
Sonny, I understand you're tipping off with a big basketball star.
Yehias, National Basketball Association superstar Kobe Bryant recently announced that this will be his final season with the Los Angeles Lakers, a team he has led to 5 championships. Kobe made the announcement on the Players Tribune website in a written reflection titled Dear Basketball. Kobe wrote, "This season is all I have left to give. My heart can take the pounding. My mind can handle the grind. But my body knows it's time to say goodbye." Kobe's retirement decision is giving fans across the league an opportunity to say their goodbyes when he and the Lakers visit their cities. The 2-time Olympic gold medalist and 17-time NBA All-Star made his final appearance here in Washington last week. VOA's Park Brewer attended the game, and he filed this report.
Playing in the nation's capital on this night in his 20th and final NBA season, 37-year-old Kobe Bryant showed many of the skills that have made him one of the NBA's all-time best players. Whether he plays at home or on the road, he has legions of followers. Here in Washington, that was no different.
I've been a Lakers fan since day one. Since the first championship, I've been a Lakers fan ever since, man. Kobe fan for life.
Joshua Bailey said it was the best gift ever when girlfriend Adrian Good got them tickets for this game.
Just a great end to a great career. You know, I think it is time for him, you know, to end. But, you know, I mean, you can't say enough about his legacy and what he meant to L.A. and just for the fans. You know?
We can't expect him to continue to go on and on, so it's just an honor to see him play for this last time, and it's just a great experience. But I'm glad he's retiring. Everybody gets a time.
Very few professional sports stars stay with one team for their entire careers, especially when others offer them more money.
Loyalty, you don't see that in players. You don't see that in football, basketball. You don't see none of that kind of loyalty in any of those sports, but it's been a blessing having Kobe on the Lakers team for 20 years.
And seeing him make amazing long-distance shots like he did throughout the game against Washington. He said afterward it was because he felt excellent physically.
When I have my legs, you know, I can go through that shot, and I feel very comfortable in that shot and stopping and pulling up. So, you know, once I knew I had my legs, I felt pretty comfortable going to it.
Kobe Bryant is expected to play before sellout crowds as he plays his final road games around the league. Afterward, he said he surprised himself how well he played, leaving the Lakers with 31 points, double his season average, and scoring what proved to be the game-winning shot in a 108-104 victory over Washington.
I was thinking about that in the locker room. I was thinking, you know, what did I do differently? It was just something, and I still don't know.
His coach, Byron Scott, also was pleasantly surprised.
I don't know, you know, how many more performances he'll have like this, but I expect him to play, you know, with that type of passion that he plays with every single night. You know, I don't know if it'll be these type of outcomes, but the one thing I do know is he'll give it everything he's got.
And that's all fans can ask for from Kobe Bryant as he says farewell during his final season. Park Brewer, VOA News, Washington.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
In September, Dikembe Mutombo received his sport's highest individual honor, induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame in the northeastern U.S. city of Springfield, Massachusetts. Our VOA basketball fans will remember Big Dikembe also went up against future Hall of Famer Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers in the 2001 NBA Finals. Mutombo was then with the Philadelphia 76ers, and Los Angeles defeated Philadelphia 4-1. Algeria and Nigeria have booked tickets to next year's Olympic men's football tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. In semifinal action Wednesday at the CAF Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Dakar, Algeria beat South Africa 2-0, and Nigeria edged host Senegal 1-0. Nigeria's captain, Otebo Ogenekaro, scored off a penalty kick in the 76th minute after a handball in the box forced the Senegalese to play the last quarter of the match with 10 men. Meanwhile, the Algerians clinched their ticket to Rio thanks to goals by Oussama Darfalou in the 8th minute and Mohamed Ben Kamassa in the 49th minute. The South Africans and the Senegalese now turn their attention to Saturday's crucial third-place match in Dakar. The winner will be Africa's final representative in the Olympic men's football competition. Algeria and Nigeria will then play an anticlimactic final in Dakar since their Olympic places are already secure. As Algerian football fans celebrate an Olympic berth, they can also revel in a great performance by one of the country's top players in the English Premier League. Our African football guru, David Legg, tells us more.
Oh, one highlight, Sonny, one that really stands out, and that makes me very proud indeed, and that's Riyad Mahrez. Riyad Mahrez is 24 years of age. He's an Algerian. He plays for the sensational English Premier League leaders, Leicester City. When you think of the EPL at the start of a season, you think Leicester are always going to be one of those clubs simply fighting to stay in the top flight. They want to get to that magical 40-point mark, because if you reach 40 points, you are assured virtually of not being relegated. No club, Sonny, that gets to 40 points has been relegated from the EPL. And interestingly, although they are now top of the table ahead of Manchester United, Manchester City, Liverpool, Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal, et al., their manager, Ranieri, an Italian, has said his first priority still, despite the fact they're top of the table, is to reach those 40 points. They've got 32 at the moment, Sonny, coming up to Christmas. He just wants to be sure that they're still going to be in the Premier League next season. And I take my hat off to him for his honesty. He's not talking about titles or playing in the Champions League in Europe. He's talking, Sonny, about making sure that they're still in the EPL next season. Back to Mahrez. He scored after 5 minutes. He scored again midway through the first half, and he scored midway through the second half away to Swansea. So he scored all three goals for Leicester in a very impressive 3-0 victory, and he made history. Riyad Mahrez became the first Algerian to score a hat-trick in the English Premier League. So that's a big, big high-five to Riyad Mahrez. And, Sonny, he is now one of two Africans among the leading four scorers in the EPL. Top scorer with 14 goals is Vardy from Leicester. And then Mahrez has got 10 goals. And then another goal at the weekend for Odion Ighalo from Nigeria. He scored for Watford in a 2-0 victory over Norwich. That's his 9th league goal of the season. So well done to Mahrez, 10 goals, and well done to Ighalo with 9 goals. So, Sonny, when it comes to the EPL, the Africans are shining very brightly. The other news, Sonny, from Europe is somebody who actually didn't score just for a change. It's Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who's been banging in the goals, 25 so far this season in all competitions. His club, Borussia Dortmund, did win 2-1 at the weekend, but just for once, the Gabonese super striker did not score. No doubt, Sonny, he'll come back with a vengeance this coming weekend.
David, World Football's governing body, FIFA, recently released its end-of-year rankings for 2015. Which teams are the tops in Africa?
I suppose it's quite appropriate that the African champions, the holders of the Africa Cup of Nations, Ivory Coast, they have finished the year on top of the FIFA ranking, Sonny, for Africa. And if we look at the top 10, they're followed by Algeria, Ghana, Cape Verde. A little bit surprising for me. I know the facts don't lie, but I do not see Cape Verde, and I've said this many times on your show, as the fourth strongest team in Africa. But nevertheless, that is where they are on the FIFA rankings. Fifth are Tunisia, and then you've got Senegal, Congo, Brazzaville, Guinea, Egypt, and Cameroon. That completes your top 10. And then we look at the next 10, Sonny, to come up to the top 20. We've got DR Congo, Mali, Uganda. Really well done for Uganda. Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea, South Africa, Zambia, Morocco, Gabon, and Benin. Comment, Sonny? Well, Cape Verde is the one that stands out to me. It's a country of only 500,000 people. Their national side, the Blue Sharks, have done really well. They're particularly competitive at home. But recently, I watched them in a World Cup qualifier playing in Nairobi and also in Praia against Kenya. And I must say, having watched them for 180 minutes, I was shaking my head just a little bit. I said, they're a competitive side. They're going to make it to the group stage. But fourth best in Africa? I have my doubts. Some of the traditional giants, they've got some catching up to do. If you look at like Egypt and Cameroon, ninth and tenth, they won't be happy with that. The Nigerians will not be happy. They're in 14th position. The South Africans certainly will not be happy to be in 16th position. And I think the fact that Zambia are placed 17th is a reminder to everybody in football in Zambia that the Chipolo Polo, they've slipped somewhat since that famous 2012 Cup of Nations victory. It's a side that needs to up its game a bit, Sonny, in 2016. But just to stress, the top three, it's Ivory Coast, Algeria, and Ghana. It's the elephants, the desert foxes, and the black stars.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a cute photo of a fox curled up in a seat at a football stadium. And I wonder if the fox is a Leicester City fan. The nickname of the first place English club is, you guessed it, the Foxes. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a nonprofit organization trying to improve reading standards in South Africa. And next, opposition People's Democratic Party leader Tenda Biti is urging Zimbabweans to reject a so-called mega China deal until their contents are made public. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin from Rwanda with My Destiny.
I don't know where to call home. I don't even know who my father is. My mother died many years ago. She didn't talk about my story. And I can see how much I'm lonely. Don't tell me to hate, cause it's love that I need. I wanna respect every person I see. The love is coming home, I live to see the future. Whatever I do, however I walk, I wanna touch my destiny. Whatever I do, however
wherever I walk, I wanna touch my destiny. Whatever I do, however I walk, I wanna touch my destiny. Whatever I do, however I walk, I wanna touch my destiny. My day, my day, my day, my destiny. Whatever it is, my destiny. My day, my day, my day, my destiny. I will reach my destiny. Whoever you are, wherever you from, I hope you can be my brother. I hope you can be my sister. Every old man I see on the street, I wish he was my father. My story taught me to love everyone. And I know, yes I know, it will help me to touch my...
Manny Martin from Rwanda with My Destiny. The South African government has built thousands of schools since the country became a democracy more than 20 years ago. Its latest budget reflects that it plans to spend about 640 billion rands, that is almost $50 billion, on basic education over the next 3 years. But the state maintains this still isn't enough to establish libraries at schools, and reading standards are dropping in South Africa. Into the breach has stepped a nonprofit called Read to Rise. Darren Taylor has more in the fourth part of a series on South Africans making a difference.
Children play at Thabo Tshekelo Primary in Soweto, the huge township south of Johannesburg. The school hasn't got many resources, but it's neat and clean. A hot wind swirls red dust around the stony playground. In the middle stands a slight, middle-aged man with kind eyes.
Business brought me to my knees and almost killed my soul and everything about me.
A decade ago, Steve Tsakaris was just like most other businessmen, always chasing money. Disenchanted, he changed his life by changing the lives of others. Tsakaris joined Read to Rise, a non-profit that distributes books in Soweto and motivates students in the lower grades of primary school to read.
Literacy is a massive problem in this country. People are illiterate. Children that are illiterate cannot be educated. So a person like that is disempowered, completely disempowered. Reading is the most fundamental of all forms of education. So maths and science are important. All of that stuff is important. But you can't do that without reading.
Tankiso Khatla is one of the teachers Tsakaris works with. She says many of her pupils, even the older ones, can't read properly.
Sometimes their reading level is too low for them to comprehend even their own classwork.
Tsakaris says many children leave school without being able to read adequately because teachers haven't got the time to instruct them properly.
The kids are slipping through the cracks of the system. The system is overloaded. The average class size that we work with in Soweto is 40 kids. That's a lot of kids for a teacher to cope with, 40 kids and above.
He adds having no libraries at most public schools in South Africa is boosting illiteracy.
Children not only can't read in this country, a lot of the children, but also they don't have access to books. Our research showed that children should be reading about 40 to 50 books a year. In most cases, they're reading none. Are you serious? You've missed us.
Yeah.
Very good.
Tsakaris addresses a class of grade 2, 8 and 9-year-olds. Read to Rise has provided them with a mini library of 50 new books with titles like Mum's Red Hat.
And the children are now excited because our focus is also about reading for pleasure. We don't give textbooks, we don't give books that are mandatory. It's kind of reading for pleasure. We want to inspire kids to read for pleasure.
Tsakaris has also given each student a new copy of the Oaky and the Sun book. On the bright cover, there's a smiling oak tree and a grinning sun wearing spectacles.
It's a story about an acorn that grows into a tree, but actually it's about the personal development of a child. It's a very symbolic, very powerful story that the children get. It's a very simple story as well. It's the first book that they've ever owned, right? They don't believe that we're giving them their own book.
But Tsakaris doesn't just hand out books, nor does he teach kids how to read. His program is designed to inspire youngsters to read more by themselves, and so to vastly improve their reading.
One, two, three.
I love to read. I love to read.
The strategy involves a lot of fun, including singing. Tsakaris singles out each child who reads for praise, making them feel special and loved.
Once upon a time, there was an acorn named Oki.
Just a few months ago, Karabo Mokere struggled to read a single sentence. Now, she often reads to Tsakaris' potential donors.
I love to read because it makes me happy, and I love to read because it makes my mind grow.
Mokere's confidence has also grown, so much that the previously reserved little girl now says she'll be a doctor one day. Sakura says her dream isn't impossible.
People that can read and can educate themselves are able to rise out of their circumstances.
Khatla says Read to Rise's books and Sakura's motivation of her pupils have transformed Thabo Tshekelo Primary.
The whole school is abuzz. They all want to be part of this reading program. We see more and more children taking up books, reading them, retaining them, taking up books, reading them, and so on, which is something that...
The teacher says her students' newfound reading skills mean their general schoolwork is now also improving. Sakura says the metamorphosis that children undergo when they embrace and enjoy reading is dramatic.
You see smiles in their faces. You see their energy change. The light comes on now that there is a way out, there's a door. We're not stuck in this box. The world is a lot bigger than we thought it was, and that's what reading does to people. It gives them access to a larger world.
Sakaris also has a vision of a different world in which the scourge of children who can't read properly is consigned to South Africa's past. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Soweto.
Hooray, I am here, shouted Oki. I am here where the bright light shines.
Last week, Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Zimbabwe. During his trip, both countries signed so-called mega deals. But opposition People's Democratic Party leader and former finance minister Tendai Biti is urging Zimbabweans to reject them until their contents are made public. Reporter Erwin Chifera of VOA's Studio 7 program to Zimbabwe has more.
Among the deals signed are the $1.4 billion and $98 million China's Export and Import Bank's concessionary loan agreements for the expansion of Wangi Power Station and Telone's fiber optic project, respectively. The other deals were agreements for the construction of the National Pharmaceutical Warehouse, New Parliament, and donation of wildlife monitoring equipment. The other agreements cover cooperation in aviation, avoidance of double taxation, and prevention of fiscal evasion, while the other ones cover the agreement on a framework on investment cooperation, and the other covers technical and economic cooperation. Biti told Studio 7, ordinary people must reject all these deals until their contents are made public and the contracts published. He adds, all these deals must be taken to Parliament for scrutiny.
What is also important is that these agreements don't prejudice Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe needs capital, but that capital must not come at a price. But I think what is key is that we demand that those agreements be tabled before Parliament, as is required by our constitution, and then Zimbabweans should study the same.
He said previous Chinese deals signed between Harare and Beijing did not benefit Zimbabweans.
For instance, the Zimbabwean government contracted the Chinese to build the Zimbabwe Defense College for $100 million. But anyone who knows will tell you that that college shouldn't have cost us more than $30 million. The Zimbabwean government contracted Senior Hydro to put the two power generators at Kariba South. Zambia did it for less than $300 million. Zimbabwe is going to pay $500 million. That's not good enough.
Former Treasury Chief Economist Masimba Manyanya tells Studio 7, while Zimbabwe desperately needs money for infrastructure development, there is need for financial and economic governance structures that protect the integrity of national policy.
If you don't have a way in which you can track funds openly, and transparent, and to check with the principles of and values of transparency and accountability, then we are evidently headed for disaster. The very term of mega deal, when the bottom has got holes, is scary.
He said there's nothing wrong with Harare borrowing money from the Chinese as long as the money is used wisely. Economic commentator Masimba Kuchera says what's worrying about the Chinese deals is the lack of transparency. He said another major area of concern was that all these Chinese-funded projects were awarded to Chinese companies, adding, in most cases, they imported every material from China, brought their own engineers, and only hired ordinary laborers in Zimbabwe. Despite all these concerns, Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa says the Chinese were playing a crucial role in reviving the country's economy, especially through power generation.
What we need is what to do in the immediate. What to do in the immediate. And there are plans to secure emergency power supply through diesel power engines. Generators.
A representative of Sinohydro, a Chinese company that has been contracted for the Wange project, Noel Gona, told the state-owned Herald newspaper recently that the project would start following President Xi's visit. He, however, said besides the Chinese loan funds, the Zimbabwean government would have to pay $300 million for the project. According to the Minister of Finance, there are more than 100 Chinese companies operating in Zimbabwe. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Wuckinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 10, 1948, still stunned by the horrendous crimes committed against civilian populations during the Second World War, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. At the time, one of the Declaration's chief architects, former First Lady and member of the United States delegation to the United Nations, Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote, "We have found that the conditions of our contemporary world require the enumeration of certain protections which the individual must have if he is to acquire a sense of security and dignity in his own person." Since 1950, the United Nations has celebrated December 10th as Human Rights Day. This day is best known for the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo, Norway. However, cultural events and exhibitions focused on various human rights themes take place around the world. This year's Human Rights Day marks the launch of a year-long campaign to highlight and preview the 50th anniversary of two important human rights documents, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Both documents were adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 16, 1966. Despite the tireless efforts and notable successes of numerous national and international agencies, non-governmental organizations, and activists all over the world, there is still much to be done. On this Human Rights Day, let us resolve to work together as a community of like-minded nations to put an end to these abuses and to hold those responsible for inflicting them to account. Ultimately, our goal is to transform our observation of December 10th as a day not about highlighting human rights abuses across the globe, but rather about commemorating the realization of full and unobstructed human rights for all people everywhere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
one of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.